Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We're at a point now where there's such a massive imbalance within most societies around the world where there simply is no choice of where we might want to put financial savings. In most places, all you can do is stick it in a private bank. We should be able to put our money in a public institution that has public purpose. And that money is then used towards where people in that community co-create the direction, the strategy of that bank, and have a say in what's done with the money that's held in the bank and with that capacity of that bank to lend out to community. You know, let's bring this to the front and think creatively. These public banks should be a hub of knowledge and expertise and of co-creating and co-designing and democratizing the ways in which we survive.
That's Thomas Marwa, one of our featured guests today, who is one of the best informed scholars on the planet about the history, role, and impact of public banks worldwide. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today, we'll be keeping our focus on how public-controlled finance, both in terms of public banks, but also other public financial institutions, are capturing meaningful new ground in their work of funding critical public needs. Today, we'll report on a new development in California that aims to immediately relieve the onerous expense of alternative bank funding for underbanked and unbanked citizens in our country, which can cost up to 10% of a family's annual income just to cash checks and access financial services. California has been a leader in adapting and adopting public banking and public finance resources with their first-in-the-nation codification of creating municipal public banks with last year's passage of AB 857, which opened the door to creating public banks in the cities of California. Now, the California legislature will be considering creating a new state-based no-cost banking network called BankCal, which will offer anyone in the state no-fee accounts, no-fee debit cards, and an online platform for payment processing and savings. This is a breakthrough model that will certainly have resonance nationally. We'll be speaking with the venerable leader of much of California's public banking efforts, Trinity Tran. Then we'll get an update from another leader in the public financing frontier, Alfeka Mutardi, who co-directs the National Infrastructure Bank Coalition, which is very actively addressing how the nation intends to pay for the trillions of dollars of infrastructure that's needed by proposing a plan to boost the president's $2.3 trillion spending plan to about $5 trillion without raising the national debt. In fact, expecting to make a profit. It's a recreation of FDR's Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was a brilliant success and gave America a head start on building the most productive and powerful economy in the world. Her report will give you some detailed insight into where this money will be going and where it will be coming from. And finally, Ellen sits down with Thomas Marwa, who opened the program. Thomas has been studying the impact of public banks on economies around the world for many years, and has just finished a book on how public banks responded to the COVID crisis internationally. The general answer, by the way, is that public banks were far better than private banks in making an impact on that pandemic crisis. You'll want to hear how he analyzes the difference that public banks make across the spectrum of needed public finance. So let's get started and talk with Trinity Tran of the California Public Bank Alliance.
Thank you.
Once again, California leads the nation in creative problem solving, or at least it's positioning itself for another round of transformative legislation. This past week, over a dozen California legislators joined together to introduce the California Public Banking Option Act, which will be known as Bank Cal, an effort to help close the widening racial and economic wealth gap that results from the lack of access to affordable banking services by a substantial number of citizens. This is a condition that affects about 25% of California residents who are either unbanked or underbanked, meaning they don't have or can't afford bank accounts. This program would be open to all Californians and provide no fee, no penalty debit accounts. Now, you may think this isn't a big deal, but nationally, private banks made over $10 billion last year in overdrafts and late fees, 80% of that money extracted from the lower 10% of earners. It's a problem that exists across the country, and this new model is an exciting development for the public banking frontier. Let's talk with Trinity Tran of the California Public Bank Alliance.
So this is a very exciting moment for public banking. We just launched AB 1177, the California Public Banking Option Act, last week, and with our co-sponsors SEIU California and the California Reinvestment Coalition, we had an incredible press conference with Congressman Ro Khanna, with Assemblymember Santiago, who of course was also our co-author on AB 857, the Public Banking Act Bill we passed in 2019, along with Assemblymember Cara Carrillo, Senator Hoyso, whom Ellen, you know, because you worked on the state bill back in 2011, that was the push to create a state public bank. So there's incredible widespread support, not only among labor, but grassroots organizations and legislators across the state for AB 1177. And this is a way to bank the unbanked and the underbanked. It creates a public infrastructure, financial infrastructure, and this is a simple way for workers and Californians across the state to open up an opt-in account provided by a public agency. And this is a way for everyone to be able to access funds through a wide network of ATMs, access automatic bill pay, set up direct deposits for employers, use a debit card. And this is all without any extractive fees. So there's a zero penalty, zero fee, zero penalty debit account and debit card. This is a simple way for people to access banking services, basic banking services. And that is incredibly important considering we have about nearly one out of four Californians don't have access to either a checking or savings account, have to use predatory payday services, half of which are Black and Latino households. So this is an incredibly important step towards helping bridge the racial and the financial wealth gap.
And the state is underwriting it. They're putting up $5 million a year for 6 years, basically to get the orchestration of it underway, but then it becomes self-sustaining. Is that right?
Yes. So the startup funds for the program will come from appropriation funds from the general funds, and that will help sustain it for the first 4 to 6 years. Once it reaches scale, it will be able to be self-sustaining with the revenues that it will be generating from the merchant's white fees.
Do you have special relationships with financial institutions that are issuing the debit card?
So this is going to be issued, the BankCal program and board will issue an RFP, and the RFP, the board will decide the administrator for the program. And it's important to note that, you know, the type of financial institutions that we envision being able to administer a BankCal account are going to be your mission-oriented CDFI community banks, credit union types. It's not going to necessarily be compatible with a traditional commercial bank who would have to submit to the various constraints and restrictions of a public program like this. And we think it would be a great opportunity for community banks and credit unions to uplift to raise their CRA rating.
Right. Well, the fees that come from credit card processing are can be considerable. So that relationship is going to be pretty important as a model for fitting.
Excuse me. You mean debit card, right? I don't think they're doing.
It's not
debit card.
Exactly.
Debit card.
But my understanding is debit card fees go to the, I mean, they go to MasterCard or Visa or whoever is the issuer, right? So isn't that an expense for the bank?
No, it's not opposing any additional fees for merchants. So the terms have already been agreed between merchants and credit card networks such as Visa and MasterCard. So these fees are already exist in their standard point of sale transaction fees. So we're not imposing any additional fees on merchants.
Well, it's a remarkable complement to the public banking agenda that California, that you guys have launched. And it kind of it doesn't preempt, but it certainly complements also the postal banking initiative too, right? Do you see an overlay or an integration of these programs with BankCal and a postal banking network?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the overarching goal of the public banking movement is to be able to democratize finance, is to provide access to all people, regardless of immigration status, regardless of how much funds you have in your bank account, to be able to access those funds. So while we're simultaneously working with the California Public Banking Alliance on AB857 local public banks, which would house city and county funds and leverage those funds for critical infrastructure projects and community development projects, while we're working on the larger wholesale banks, it's also important to be able to immediately address the needs of low-income communities, especially Black and brown people of color who've been shut out of the traditional banking service. So we see this as a very complementary effort, along with postal banks, which, you know, AB857 within this 1177 bill, there actually is a provision for 857 banks to potentially hold these CalLIF accounts. So with postal banking, if that were to come to fruition, maybe down the road, we could carve out something for postal banks to actually hold these accounts.
Yeah.
That would be great because they've got the infrastructure. They've already got the post
Absolutely.
Office.
Absolutely. You know, we were discussing that among the legislation and policy team while we were writing this, but unfortunately, since the public postal banking is still in the ideation phase, whereas with 857, we can point to existing state law. So that is included in the current AB 1177 bill. But we're watching and supporting the postal banking movement. And then we're also excited about AOC's bill that she's going to be introducing in the next, we're hearing between now and June in the next few months, and that the Federal Public Banking Act legislation, which is going to essentially make it easier for cities and states across the nation to be able to form public banks. So this is, I think, Ellen, Brad, you had written an article saying that this is a watershed moment for public banking, and it is. It's incredible to see the support from grassroots to grasstop to legislators across the country moving towards this idea. This is a long time in coming.
Well, Trinity, thank you so much for spending a little time with us and giving us a postage stamp size nutshell of great information and good news. And we, of course, will be following it, as this develops too.
So thank you, Walt. Thank you, Walt. Thank you, Ellen, always the godmother and the godfather of the public banking movement. Honored to carry your legacy.
Thank you.
Honored to have you. That's great.
You'll recall how elusive getting infrastructure funding together at the national level has been. It's not like there's no urgency. The American Society of Civil Engineers keeps downgrading America's infrastructure, and now we're solidly in the category of getting D's across a wide spectrum of critical infrastructure categories. But now there seems to be a new prospect for actually getting a few trillion bucks together to make solid headway. Our guest, Alfeka Mutardi, who is co-director of the National Infrastructure Bank Coalition, has an update for us today on how their effort to recreate the Reconstruction Finance Corporation's success of the 1930s is faring in the conversation that's underway in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to the show, Alfeka. Alfeka Mutardi is the co-director for the National Infrastructure Bank Coalition, and truly one of the really exciting things that's going on in this new world of public finance is on the infrastructure front end. We have heard rumors of infrastructure bills and efforts by previous administrations, and nothing has happened, virtually nothing. And we're all very familiar with the PPPs, you know, the public-private partnerships that have been very expensive and really, you know, great for Wall Street, but not so great for us. So Alfeca, welcome. Please just refresh our audience, because I know you and Ellen talked a little bit ago about what the National Infrastructure Bank is, but just bring us back up to speed and give us a snapshot of that.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. So last time I was on your show, thank you very much. We talked about a bill that was introduced into Congress, H.R. 6422, introduced into the last Congress, which would create a $4 to $5 trillion bank to lend for infrastructure projects all across the country. Now, since we last met, there have been a few developments. The first thing that happened was the American Society of Civil Engineers came out with a new report card on infrastructure. And boy, their numbers are much bigger than they were before. So I'll go into that in just a second. And then the second thing that happened is the Biden administration came into power in January, and then proceeded to roll out quite a number of very ambitious plans in their first 100 days to provide stimulus for people affected by the COVID pandemic and shutdown. And most recently, they have unveiled a new infrastructure and jobs plan. So that has ramifications and changes for for the bill and the overlap between these two things. The bank was last sized to provide funding up to $4 trillion. But what happened, as I mentioned, was that the American Society of Civil Engineers came out with a new report card. And what they've said is that in addition to giving grades in 17 different categories they cover, they also said that our total need for infrastructure has now grown to $6.1 trillion over 10 years. Wow. And furthermore, they say that of that $6.1 trillion, maybe $3.5 trillion is slated to be funded through the existing mechanisms. However, a funding gap of $2.6 trillion remains. And we want our infrastructure bank to be able to cover all of the funding gap for infrastructure. We've planned in $2.6 trillion for the bank to finance. In addition, we expanded the definition that the engineers normally cover, and we want to put in more for affordable housing, high-speed rail, broadband everywhere, and then some large mega projects. So that adds another 2.4. So altogether, we're going to cover $5 trillion. Now, how does that compare with the Biden plan, and what is the overlap between the two? The Biden plan was just announced last week, last Wednesday, and was estimated to provide financing over the next 10 years of $2.25 trillion. And that covers, when you break it out, just short of $1 trillion for infrastructure proper, and then some of the added categories, which they're also going to cover, a little bit of affordable housing. They might cover all of the broadband everywhere rollout. And then they have some other items in here that are not infrastructure per se, but relate to the care economy and workforce training and that kind of thing. So actually, this is almost exactly the same amount that the House requested and passed last summer for in the DeFazio infrastructure bill. Not too much different. The components are a little bit different. There's less for roads and bridges, amazingly enough. And then they've added in a line here for electric car vehicles. So altogether, this amount of less than $1 trillion falls within what the engineers estimated the federal government would cover. So even with the Biden plan, this gap still remains. So it is still very much the case that the infrastructure bank is needed. We need them both. If we want to cover all the infrastructure, if we want to have a place for electric cars to drive on so that they're not hitting potholes and not going over a bridge that may collapse or anything like that, we have to finance this full funding gap for roads and bridges, the full funding gap for water infrastructure that includes all of the need to replace the lead pipes in water. That by itself, the engineers estimate just by itself is $286 billion just for lead pipes. So you can see that this Biden plan number is still low. Out of the financing gap that still remains after the Biden plan, we still need an extra $1.2 trillion for roads and bridges and an extra $1.1 trillion for water infrastructure. And then none of the Biden plan includes high-speed rail. And this is really a big favorite with everybody. We want to move across the country faster. We want to develop the country economically like China did with its high-speed rail. And we estimate we need another trillion for that. So the bank will cover all of these things at $5 trillion large that are not included in the Biden plan. We're waiting to see how the Biden plan works out. It's, of course, announced to be financed by taxes, worldwide corporate taxes, and raising our domestic corporate tax rate. That'll cover most of the Biden plan, but will need to be spread out over 15 years to cover it all. And by comparison, the National Infrastructure Bank will not require any new taxes or create any new debts or deficits. So it's a great way to top up the Biden plan and provide all of our infrastructure and make it safe and make our infrastructure safe and resilient in the United States.
Thanks, Elfeca. My concern on the Biden plan or any infrastructure bank plan that isn't a bank is that it will wind up in public-private partnerships and the private part will get all the profits. It seems to me the most efficient thing would be to take some of that money that they're talking about in Congress and using it to capitalize the National Infrastructure Bank. Is there any chance of slipping that possibility into your bill?
So actually, we don't need anything from the budget. That's the beauty of this Hamiltonian bank. Actually, it gets itself capitalized from going to the private sector, asking private holders of treasuries who keep them as a form of long-term savings, could be a pension plan or a state rainy day fund or even a corporation or a foreign government. And we ask them, would they like to sell us temporarily their treasuries in exchange for preferred stock in the bank? And that will completely capitalize the bank. And then the bank will proceed on its own to pay its own way, give out loans, earn interest, and then even pay back to the government something that it took on the interest side for the capitalization process. But altogether, we don't really, will we need to burden, because as a macroeconomist, like what I can tell you is that the federal budget is exceedingly burdened right now. We have low taxes coming in and we have very high expenditures and costs going out. And then with COVID, we've added to deficits and debts $4.5 trillion over the last 13 months. And this is really endangering the financial sector. It's causing interest rates to spike, and that's going to have a whole ripple effect right through the stock market. So it's important that this Biden plan gets passed. Don't forget the Biden plan is spending, not lending. And the infrastructure bank is a lending bank, just like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was during the New Deal. So we want to have this Biden plan passed. Without it, we won't have enough money to cover all of the infrastructure. And then we want this National Infrastructure Bank, without creating any more burden on government, to come and top it up. I agree with you with respect to what you said about public-private partnerships. They oftentimes run into difficulties. They have high internal rates of return, and they oftentimes don't do their job. Their job is supposed to be to design, build, operate and maintain over a 35-year period, and oftentimes they don't do that job and may go bankrupt or any other kind of thing can happen. So we need to have careful administration where we do have public-private partnerships. But for the most part, we want to keep public infrastructure in public hands and let it be administered in such a way that these new investments will really grow the economy, and that new growth will result in new taxes being collected at the state and local level to allow local entities to repay back the loans.
Elfeca, when you talk about administration, one of the things that we really liked about the NIB 6422 was that there was an agency for coordinating the construction projects. Is that present in the Biden plan, or is it a really importantly missing component?
It's been the case all along for the last 60 years that paying for infrastructure through the budget has very much been a silo type of endeavor. And that's why roads and bridges under the Transportation Committee of the House got the lion's share of the money. And even though the whole package has been dwindling over time, we used to spend 4% of GDP on infrastructure through the budget, and now it's down to less than 2.5% of GDP. And the lion's share has gone to roads and bridges. And what's gotten squeezed out of the mix has been water infrastructure. Right. So in the 1970s, for example, the federal budget used to spend 33% of all the investments in water infrastructure as a result passing the Clean Water Act. And now it's down to only 3%. So water has been the big loser in all of this. And so has transit and rail.
How is the traction on Capitol Hill at this point? There are several other bills that are afoot. Obviously, we like this one the best. Has this idea been presented to the Biden team? And what's their take on it?
It has. Coming out of the starting gate when the administration got started, right, and the progressive movement was having a big input into this, they very much wanted to have a climate change component to this. However, they came up with a price tag of something like $10 trillion. That's the Ed Markey plan. And then when the economists really looked at how much can we really afford to push through the budget, then the budget constraint came hitting home, especially as we've had this big, huge increase in interest rates. Since last October, they were about 0.5% for 10-year treasuries, and now they're up to 1.7%. And that's just as a result of trying to squeeze all this new deficit spending into treasuries, into financial markets. There's just no place for it to go. So that meant that the whole Biden plan was winnowed down to what we see as this present $2.25 trillion package. And there's just really little left over to put into the budget through the budget process. And that's why we absolutely, definitely need a bank. The team that's been developing this Biden plan, we think, is Brian Deese and the National Economic Affairs Committee of the White House, sort of the infrastructure czar, if you will, and coordinating it with a big, bold jobs plan, having only $1 trillion, which is simply the reauthorization from last year, presented now, is not as big and bold a jobs plan as we had hoped. But if we add on $5 trillion onto that, then we have a nice, big, bold jobs plan. And to really supercharge the American economy and pour more money into the real sector of the economy, make the economy more productive. So we're hoping they're still considering a national infrastructure bank as a priority. So we're still communicating to push this initiative.
You're doing great work on this.
Thank you.
And we would certainly love to have a new RFC on board our common bank. It would be terrific to move on from there. Yeah.
The lessons learned from the Great Depression are really remarkably like they are today. They couldn't fit things through the budget either to go out and hire workers who were made on, you know, the 20% unemployment that was faced during the Great Depression, nor to build all the new public facilities that they wanted. And the RFC was an instrumental bank in financing all that. It was so large. It was bigger than the federal budget. It was bigger than all the commercial banks combined. And it was the lender of last resort. FDR always went to the banking sector and said, would you like to fund this, finance this project? And if you're not going to do it, the RFC is going to do it. And that's exactly how this bank would work as well.
Thank you so much for the time today. Everybody, you should got to check this out, a very thorough site, National Infrastructure Bank Coalition. It's nibcoalition.com.
Cop.com. And there's an article on there summarizing what I've just said to you, an analysis of the Biden plan.
And be sure to sign up for the newsletter too. Altheca really gives you chapter and verse about every week, replete with all the details. It's pretty fabulous. Thank you so much, Altheca.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Great talking to you. It's my pleasure to be talking again to Thomas Marwa, who is a senior lecturer of development studies at SOAS, University of London, a senior research fellow in patient finance and banking at the University College London, Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose, and a research associate with the Municipal Services Project. His research focuses on public banks and decarbonization, definancialization, and democratization. His current project at University College London is called PUFIN, Priming Public Financial Institutions for Green Innovation Project, a three-year project funded by EIT Climate KIC. So we'll have to talk about that. His research centers around public banks and the financing of sustainable development. And his newest book is Public Banks, Decarbonization, Definancialization, and Democratization, which will be out later this year. He's also co-authored or co-edited several other books, including one that we particularly want to discuss right now, which is called Public Banks and COVID-19, Combating the Pandemic with Public Finance, which was published last year. I actually wrote a chapter in it, but not the most important thing in it. You wrote a chapter. Oh, so Thomas, great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ellen. It's lovely to talk with you again, to be on the show again. And my goodness, the way you introduced me, it sounds like I'm a busy guy on public banks. But it's a passion of mine, and it's a passion that, you know, really I've worked on alongside you, and really I've learned from your work and admire your work, you yourself, but also, of course, the public bank. So,
well, I consider you the world's foremost expert in public banking globally. I mean, I do have a certain expertise, but it's not as broad as yours. I think that's great.
Well, I think we all work together on this, and it's very much, I think, probably more than any sort of current contemporary topic that, you know, really didn't have a profile 10 or 15 years ago, much of a profile. You know, the discussion of public banks has really been, I think, a collaborative effort, you know, driven, you know, much by you and then a few other of us kind of working around it for the last 10 years. And now it's just like, bang, wow, suddenly everybody's rediscovered it, that there's something of interest here.
Yeah. So you had actually collated what percentage of banks are public banks or what percentage of banking assets globally. I've forgotten the actual numbers. They seem to change periodically, but what's the figure now?
They do change, and it's hard to know exactly why they change so much. But the numbers that I'm working with right now that I put in the book, and you know, 910 public banks worldwide. So that's including your sort of commercial retail banks, those public banks that take deposits and write checks and things like that. But it also includes universal ones that do the checking and banking and stuff, but also do more development or community-oriented development projects. And then the pure development or investment-type banks, like the KfW in Germany or like the BNDES in Brazil, that are really, you know, focused on project lending, infrastructure investment, things like that. And they don't have necessarily day-to-day contact with people. So 910 of those. My estimates in terms of how much money or assets they have is that they're $49 trillion in combined assets worldwide, which is, you know, mind-boggling. And also, it's far more than what the so-called experts in banking, like the World Bank, suggest there are. So the World Bank has been saying for years, you know, we've got maybe two or three, maybe five, you know, $1 trillion in public banking assets. And it's in fact 10 times that. So there's, you know, the point there being is there's a lot of capacity, a lot of examples, a lot of interesting and diverse types of public banks around the world.
And of course, you've noted in that the COVID book that public banks shone in this crisis. I mean, the crisis itself has shown a light on how fragile our whole global banking system is. Do you want to go into that and why public banks have done better overall, although some public banks didn't do so well? So those are all interesting points of discussion.
Yeah, not all of them have done well, but in general, some of the lessons that the bank or the book that we drew out of the book on average is that public banks can really step in at a time of crisis. And this is something that we all know they've done historically and for a long, long time. So they're able, and they did in the context of COVID, in many cases, sort of respond very quickly, very rapidly, with quite significant support measures, loans, grants, guarantees for everything from, you know, basic healthcare provisioning, like giving money to health providers so they can pay their workers or buy personal protective gear and equipment, to supporting small, medium-sized enterprises, to quite a fair amount of student loan supports even. So, and you know, public banks as diverse as the Bank of North Dakota to the China Development Bank, you know, from a very small, relatively small bank, you know, in North Dakota to like the, one of the largest banks in the entire world saying, oh, you know what, actually we should worry about the students and let's do that. And doing it very quickly. So, you know, it's important. And one of the other really, I think, key messages that came out in the book, and one of the differences between, talked about the banks that maybe didn't do so well and those that have been doing better, at least a measure of impact on society, is that public purpose mandates were very important. So those banks that were legislated and had mandates that were connecting them to the public interest, to the public good, to society, and you know, this is a public interest bank, they're the ones that really stepped in quite quickly and very little or much less regard for the financial impact on their bottom line. So the KfW, clear public interest bank, owned, controlled by the government for the people, for the society, is going to lose a lot of money. This year. It's going to rack up in the ring. You know, I think in the first half of 2020, it lost 500 million euros. A lot, but it has the, you know, it's built up capacity over years that can absorb that.
So how can it afford to lose money though? Doesn't that make it bankrupt, or did they allow it to continue operating anyway?
Well, it makes a lot, it, you know, yeah, of course it continued to operate.
That's taken out of its profits.
It's taken out of its, as you know, year in, year out, you know, it deals in about $80 billion in loans annually, loans, credits. And it makes a small return on that of about 0.4% on that. So, it's earning several hundred million euros a year, which then goes back into its reserves. So when at a time of crisis, then it's able to draw on those reserves. At the same time, the German government, and this goes back to its public purpose mandate, is that Angela Merkel said, lend without limit. We've got your back. We're going to support what you do. We need you. We know you need to react at this time. So go ahead and do it and don't worry. And then they have the capacity and expertise to sort of unroll those programs.
Mm-hmm. So, I didn't hear the first line you said. Merkel said what?
Lend without limit.
Oh, lend without limit.
As you need to do, and we've got your back. I mean, I don't think she said we've got your back specifically. That's not a direct quote, but that was the intention. Right? Yeah. And I mean, this was repeated in various forms and different ways of different public banks around the world. Because they were, where they had a public purpose mandate, they were following that mandate. Mm-hmm. Whereas, as we show in the book, some of the other banks, more commercially or corporatized banks, particularly in Latin America, some of the Argentinian and Brazilian banks were much more concerned about protecting their bottom line. And that really then affected their programs were far less bold, far less sort of leaning into the crisis and more almost acting as if they were private profit-seeking banks in some cases, which is a result of 20, 30 years of sort of neoliberal restructuring to make them function as if they were private profit-seeking.
So the government actually wants them to turn a profit, is that right? It's the government that tells them, okay. In China, they just write off their non-performing loans or just, you know, leave them hanging there as non-performing loans and don't seem to worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways that they deal with them. They have their really big asset management corporations where if there's, you know, loans really get too big and too unmanageable, then they package them up and then sort of pass them off into the asset management corporations who then find other ways of dealing with them. But they work with the losses and they manage it within and through the public sphere, right? So they're not relying simply on market signals for the success of the bank or not. This is something that's common across those public banks that are connected to some form of public purpose and are not there just to make money, but are guided by a mandate and missions around SME lending, municipal infrastructure lending, water, which is a topic very close to my heart. You know, there's been a lot of support for public and equitable water provisioning, especially at the time of COVID, because it was so central to overcoming trying to. We're still nowhere near overcoming the pandemic yet, but you can't very well hope to do that if you can't wash your hands. So if you don't have that, it really exposed the necessity, continued access to essential public services like water, but also where people don't have that, you know, we really need to put some more effort and money and capacity, things like public water.
So which of the public banks have been particularly successful and which not so successful and what the difference is?
So one very interesting case is the Council of Europe Development Bank, which is a relatively little known bank, but unique because it has an explicitly social mandate. It is really about social investment, supporting the most vulnerable in society. And it then unrolled a very rapid program around supports for countries and municipalities responding to COVID. European Investment Bank, another example of sort of strong response on top of the KfW. And then in Italian, the Cassa Depositi Investiti, forgive my Italian accent, was another chapter. In the Portuguese example, were all sort of quite strong examples of public banks quite linked to a public mandate. The weaker examples, certainly looking at the Turkish public banks, that have been in many ways corporatized, that have been pushed to be more profitable. But then there's also problems of political manipulation in that particular case. Even though the Turkish banks, in sort of legal terms, have much stronger rules around political separation between the operation of the bank, it's more of an ideal world bank type of bank where it's been corporatized and the operations have been set off and not supposedly interfered with by political forces. It does the worst. Whereas in cases like Germany, the KfW, the Italian, the Portuguese, and so on banks, where there's a direct political link and they're clearly understood as political banks, as arms of the government and a public purpose, they did far, far better in terms of their response. And certainly there are problems in terms of the one chapter on India, our colleague was quite critical of the poor response of the Indian banks to the crisis in general. More of a historical understanding of a sort of withering of support for public banks in some sectors of India, certainly not all.
I remember in the 2008-2009 crisis, the Landesbank in Germany got in trouble, and that was supposedly because they were pushed to compete with finance, you know, to be profitable, and that's where they failed because they got into these very risky investments, whereas the sarcasm banks obviously have done very well.
Yeah, and precisely. Where public banks have been pushed towards the ideal that the World Bank and the IMF and the OECD had wanted them to go prior to the global financial crisis and certainly prior to COVID, meaning to be more market-oriented, more profitable, they're the banks that have always gotten in trouble. Were the banks where they've been pushed to be more profitable and more corporatized and more sort of market-facing, if you will, they're the ones that got in trouble in the global financial crisis, and they're the ones that have responded comparatively weaker terms. Those banks that understand their public purpose and are connected to society and to the government and, you know, in ways that, let's say, support planning, support societal responses to development challenges, environmental challenges. Those are the ones that have responded more progressively and more forcefully to the COVID crisis. They understand themselves as part of, almost in a sense, you know, like a public utility or, you know, a responsibility first and foremost to providing for society rather than for padding their bottom line.
I noticed there in the introduction to the COVID book, it was pointed out that banks, of course, can do what governments can't, which means expand the actual money in the system, whereas governments have to get the money one-to-one, either from taxes or from borrowing. Banks are able to leverage 10-to-1, so they can actually create the money before it's there. So you could go out there and build the thing before you've got the money, and then the thing you built can pay it back, which is great. But one problem we have just getting our public banks set up is where do you get the money to capitalize them? We have a very promising national infrastructure bank bill on right now, HR 6422, that we think is very good, but they also have a little problem with the capitalization. I mean, it's kind of, anyway, do you want to explain where these more successful banks get their capital?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably their initial capital comes from government. So at the national level, there's various ways that a government can fund these things. They can directly put X amount of dollars or lira or euros or whatever into the bank. In countries like the US or Germany or the UK, you know, in many ways, they can sort of just borrow that money from itself, from its own central bank or Federal Reserve, and then capitalize the bank. But the initial chunk of money that sort of gives weight or foundation to public bank, inevitably, almost by definition, is going to come from the public sector, from the government. And then you can use that initial capital stake, and there's different ways they can put the initial chunk of money in, and then the government can also say, we guarantee you X, you know, amount of extra dollars or euros by which you can lend as you need it. So you can mix sort of an initial sort of deposit in the new bank plus a promises to pay in the future that the bank can then take, you know, say it's whatever, 10 billion or 100 billion, doesn't matter what it is. And then, you know, magnify that and lend at an excess of it. So that's, you know, that's the power of it. And it's particularly important for municipalities and states and regions where they have more limited capacity to sort of draw. They don't have their own central bank and they have less access to international financial markets than a national government. So if cities and regions and at the national, of course, level, of course, can begin building up that sort of those reserves and that capacity monetarily within public banks, but then also capacity in terms of knowledge and expertise and connections with one's community, that pays dividends in terms of its, you know, ability to affect and shape and direct, you know, change in society, in the economy, and to, you know, when we're talking about things like responding to a crisis like COVID, fundamentally important, as we see, they can just do it by being, you know, asked to do it. Or in terms of these much, you know, even bigger questions of fundamentally shifting how we reproduce ourselves at a societal level in terms of decarbonization, in terms of climate change, of green and just transitions, they can take a real leading role in really moving and shifting the way that we survive and hopefully survive, but the way that we reproduce ourselves as societies, which simply will not come from private banks. And from investors, they want more surety of their returns, and they sort of pile into certain trends if they see, you know, it going well. So you get big housing bubbles, you get bubbles in tech, you get you know, GameStop bubbles, all these things that are in fact meaningless if we're not fundamentally shifting ourselves to a greener and more just form of society. And that's where public banks can and should play an absolute leading role.
Yeah, I saw an emphasis, or also in the introduction to the COVID book, that public banks are a potential path toward democratization. It seems to me that private banks are a path toward the opposite. I mean, there really is a political element in it. Or if you think about our original mom and pop capitalism, where you had every household or many households had their own farms and their own little businesses, and they all competed with each other. And that was fair, and that was democratic, and that was good. But now we have a system where it's possible for somebody, one person, to have $100 billion. I mean, what can you do with $100 billion? You can buy up politicians, you can buy universities, you can buy newspapers and TV stations, and you can manipulate the system so that the voice of the people is absolutely drowned out, or the people don't even know what their voice is because what they're hearing in the news, et cetera, is propaganda for a particular position. Anyway, do you want to go into the democratization aspect?
Sure. No, it's my pleasure. I love talking about this because I agree with you. I think it's very difficult if we can't have some kind of democratic say over the financial resources, the money resources we have held within our society. It just doesn't make a lot of sense, especially, you know, I know a lot of the struggle in the United States right now with the public banks is one, getting new ones set up. But then part of the debate is, should this be, or can we make this a legally depository holding bank? So like a basic democratic demand from people should be that, or they should be able to say, you know, we've got these public services, we've got governments, we've got hospitals, we've got all these things, you know, in community councils or whatever, they have sources of money. Why can't we put them into a public bank? And why can't we hold them in a, you know, public institution to support other public institutions? And this seems then to be, a big debate, as if there's something wrong with, setting up a public bank that can hold public funds. And it really is, we're at a point now where, as you say, there's such a massive imbalance within most societies around the world, most countries, where there simply is no choice. We've lost the choice of where we might want to put, you know, some of our financial savings, however meager or large they might be. In most places, all you can do is stick it in a private bank. We should be able to have a choice to be able to put our money in a public institution that has public purpose. And that money is then used towards, ideally then, in terms of shaping those institutions. And they exist in cases like KfW and the Banco Popular in Costa Rica and in other forms of different banks around the world, where people in that community have means to impact or to shape, co-create the direction, the strategy of that bank, and have a say in what's done with that money that's held in the bank and with that capacity of that bank to lend out to community. Things like, you've got this Council of Europe Bank, it has a social mission. It's lending towards social housing. It's also got a mission to be green. So it's trying to move, and it has a vision of moving towards making social housing that is also energy efficient. This sounds reasonable to me, right? This is very, like, we've got a huge climate crisis. We've got a crisis of housing. Let's match those. And I know this is a big issue among many of the various public banking movements in the U.S., like how do you deal with the inequality, the housing crisis, the exclusion of different communities and racialized communities. You know, let's bring this to the front and think creatively, bringing together something like a public bank that would have the financial capacity and expertise, find forms and democratize means by which we can connect them to communities to have that discussion about what their priorities are. Find other actors in society that then, you know, if it's about housing, let's figure out how we can build this, how we can green it. Bring together, these public banks should be a hub of knowledge and expertise and of co-creating and co-designing and democratizing the ways in which we survive. And I think that really has to be where they go and the ways in which we should be sort of fighting to make public banks, how they should be institutionalized, how they should be created.
Yeah, that's great. Do you want to talk a little bit about your project with Puffin?
Sure. I mean, it's actually kind of what I was just talking about. So I've got this 2-year contract, and we've been funded to do this this project on priming public finance institutions for green innovation. And much of it is about doing what we were creating, what we call labs. So just making a sort of sphere or a place where we can discuss with public banks, with their own members or their own sort of staff and experts within the bank about what they're doing, thinking about it in terms of, you know, what are the key kinds of missions and, or, you know, that you want to resolve the grand challenge in society, especially around greening, you know, decarbonization, equitable water, clean water, these sorts of things. Also then creating another sphere where we bring into the same room the public banking people with stakeholders in societies, civil society groups, water providers, people who are interested or want to work on green energy and so on, and start talking about that problem and start trying to find ways by which we can resolve it collectively and in ways that are socially credible, that there's a connection to society and that the decisions that are made have a rooting in that community. For me, this is really significant because somebody sent me a paper today about called something in the effect of green wishing, that we can wish that this green transformation is going to be without any, you know, any dislocation or any trouble, or we can just wish that market's going to resolve all the problems and we're all going to become wealthier and healthier in a green transition. The reality is that there's going to be dislocations, that there's going to be things are going to go wrong from time to time. People are going to make mistakes. Public banks will make mistakes. Governments will make mistakes. And there's going to be, we're going to have to shift how the way we sort of survive as society and reproduce ourselves. We need to make those decisions together. So when, you know, when things go great, we can celebrate that. When things go wrong, we accept that as a society and collectively and say, okay, it went wrong. Doesn't mean we give up on decarbonization. Doesn't mean we give up on the future of society, but let's try something new. And we accept that and move on. And that means a very different way of financing the future. Something that I think, you know, sort of where we began this last little bit, it's simply not happening in the private sector. And I don't think it's particularly possible given their responsibility to shareholders and, you know, they're just sort of motivating force, which is to maximize returns. If they can do that in a green way, great. If they can't, then so be it. The evidence is that private banks have simply not been the driving force behind green transformation, you know, and they're not doing it at the scale, rate, or speed necessary. And that's where we need public banks that can be commanded to do so democratically in the public interest.
That's great. Well, I think that's a good place to conclude.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm always happy to talk about this, and it's great to talk with you about it, Ellen, for sure.
Yeah, thank you for your great work. I forgot to mention that you're on the advisory board of the Public Banking Institute, which we're very pleased to have you and your expertise.
It's a pleasure of mine. Admire the work that Public Banking Institute is doing.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Thomas Marois, who is a senior research fellow in patient finance and banking at the University College London Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.